From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Journalist Frances Dinkelspiel discovered thousands of pieces of paper about her great-great-grandfather, Isaias Wolf Hellman, and she began to realize what a remarkable contribution he had made to California's economic history. The book she produced is titled Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California. She joins us for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. A fifth-generation San Franciscan, Frances Dinkelspiel, went to Stanford and Columbia and became reporter and journalist for Syracuse New York newspapers and the San Jose Mercury News. She also discovered the nearly forgotten historical legacy of her great-great-grandfather, a Jewish Bavarian immigrant named Isaias Wolf Hellman, a banking pioneer who founded Los Angeles's first successful bank, the Farmer and Merchant Bank, and transformed Wells Fargo Bank into one of the West's premier financial institutions. Hellman also helped to establish the Los Angeles Times and the universities of California in Southern California, and he was the state's premier money man in the late 19th and early 20th century, investing in eight of California's central industries, including transportation, land development, water, electricity, and oil, and for nearly two decades controlling the state's wine industry. Frances Dinkelspiel's book is called Towers of Gold. She joins us for this hour, as does another Hellman descendant, venture capitalist and philanthropist and banjo player Warren Hellman. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm pleased to have you here. Well, this is quite a story, and let's start at the beginning, because you're sitting there in the California Historical Society, 50,000 pieces of paper. I mean, that in itself must have been pretty daunting, but you wanted to find out who this guy was.
That's right. I had grown up always knowing that my family had something to do with Wells Fargo Bank, but I'd never been entirely sure what that meant. And I had been writing for the San Jose Mercury News and other newspapers and decided to try my hand at some personal essays. So I went to the California Historical Society thinking I'd just, you know, dabble in a few letters and things of Isaias Hellman and add those documents to my personal essays. But when I got there, the archivist showed me 40 boxes of Hellman material. And I was just, of course, completely daunted by this prospect. He was a pack rat who saved everything. So I just started to go through these papers, and I was amazed at what I came across. All these iconic names from the 19th century kept popping off the pages. Names like Collis Huntington, the builder of the Transcontinental Railroad, Henry Huntington, his nephew, who was instrumental in transportation systems all throughout California, Levi Strauss, Meyer Lehman, John Mackey. All these men, it turned out, had been business partners of Isaias Hellman. And the more I poked through these papers, the more I realized that there was this wonderful story that had been largely forgotten about this banker who'd sort of helped pull together all these disparate strands to create California.
It became part of the dustbin of history, really, to a great degree, despite the fact that, your subtitle, which I think an LA Times reviewer said they'll be forgiving for, because it does sound histrionic, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California. And yet, in many ways, well, he made quite a formidable contribution to the creation of the state as we know it.
That's right. As I went through, no one had tracked Hellman's accomplishments and development. So a large part of the process for me was just essentially noting down what he did and trying to create this business timeline. And what I finally concluded was that Isaias Hellman was instrumental in the development of at least eight industries in California. Of course, there was banking. At the end of his life, he ended up as president of Wells Fargo Bank. But there was also transportation and oil. He helped really jumpstart the discovery of oil in California. He controlled the wine industry. He owned vast amounts of land and did a lot of development in LA. Plus, he was a large owner of various water companies in Southern and Northern California. And it's almost as if he was a Zelig-like character. If you look really hard at
People may not know Zelig from Woody Allen. He was the character who was always ubiquitous everywhere, you know, who just appeared everywhere.
If you poke hard enough in a lot of business deals, if you look hard in the background, there's Hellman.
He came from Bavaria, and what's interesting to me is he came from a place called Beckendorf, which, a lot of people came from. Again, this is something that we generally kind of ignore as far as history is concerned.
Yeah, Reckendorf is a really small town in southeastern Germany. But as it turns out, a lot of families who went on to become very prominent in California history came from this town. The Hellman family, Isaias Hellman, also the Haas family. There were a number of Haas cousins who came to California who started out as dry goods merchants. And of course, they went on today to be the owners of Levi Strauss & Company and one of the most philanthropic families in California.
Well, Warren Hellman continues that philanthropic legacy. He's a leading venture capitalist with a venture capital firm, founder of Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival and great-great-grandson. Did you know about this? This is your great-grandfather. It's Francis's great-great-grandfather.
Well, some. I mean, not probably more than Francis did, but living in New York for 18 years, it always kind of bothered me because the leading New York Jewish families have done a lot to promote their name and history, whether it's the Lehmans, the Loebs, others. And there was very little, you know, I kept thinking, hey, my great-grandfather was better than any of those guys. And there was very little, you know, it was sort of, I mean, the Lehmans would say, oh, yeah, we're cousins somehow. And so when Francis, and I guess I was interviewed once, and the person said, if you could be anybody in history, who would you like to be? And I said, my great-grandfather. It didn't take an instant to answer the question.
Well, it is an extraordinary story. It's, as Francis has pointed out, it's a rags-to-riches story. He came here at 16 years old with really virtually nothing, and by the time he was 20, had his own store and then had a safe. The safe was kind of one of the keys to his success, I think, wasn't it, Francis?
Yeah, he opened his own dry goods store in 1865, and as a courtesy, he had a safe in the back of the store where he stored gold and valuables for his customers. Now, banks were illegal in California until the 1870s, and so Hellman was happy to store gold in this safe until he had this run-in with this irate Irishman one day. The man had come to Hellman's store and deposited this heavy bag of gold, but then he'd gone out and proceeded to get gloriously drunk, come back to the safe, asked for some more money, went out and got drunk again, came back and got more money, and he repeated this pattern for over a series of days. And when he finally sobered up, he came back to get his pouch, which of course at that time was empty and not full with gold. And he lunged at Hellman. He called him a dirty Jew, and he tried to attack him. But fortunately, he had a friend who stopped him. But that interaction made Hellman realize that he couldn't continue this informal banking operation he had going on. So he went and had some deposit slips made up, and he formalized banking relations, and he consequently became the first sort of official banker in Los Angeles.
There's also a story, I'm jumping ahead here, where he's walking down the street just doing his daily ablutions or whatever you want to call them, and suddenly somebody comes after him. I mean, it was a day when people used to shoot capitalists, and somebody saw him as a scapegoat and really just tried to shoot him.
Yeah, and in February 1895, you know, Hellman was living in the Western Addition then, which was an enclave for wealthy German and Central European Jews. I mean, Van Ness Avenue at that time was sort of this lined with, you know, rows of trees and huge mansions. And Hellman lived in that area. And one day he went to work, and as he was walking down the street, he was at an intersection of California near Polk, and a man said to him, "Mr. Hellman?" Hellman turned around, and the man said, "I'm going to kill you." And he ended up shooting at Isaias Hellman, who quickly ran away, zigzagged his way down the street, and fortunately survived for Warren and myself.
Well, the guy shot himself, too.
And then the guy shot himself right there on the street.
And shot himself. And Warren, when you decided to write a song about this great-grandfather of yours, was it as a result of all the work that your cousin did, or was this before all that?
Oh, no. It was absolutely a result of Francis's book. I thought it would be fun to write a song about Isaias, and clearly this incident became sort of, the most interesting verse in the song, but definitely the song came from the book, or came from Francis. So.
Should we hear the song? Can we do that? Let's do it. This is "O Isaias" by Warren Hellman and his band, the Wronglers.
I. W. Hellman, he was a pioneer. Came to California in his 16th. Isthmus to come here and become California's greatest financier. Isaias went to work in a dry goods store. Says because I am probably a banker at my core.
Oh, I guess you're the founder of the clan. Oh, I guess you might fall out of pen. Oh, I guess opportunity you ran. Oh, I guess you were a mighty man.
Mighty man indeed. Well, if we know the money-making gene came to you, Warren, but what about the banjo? Was he at all musical? Do we know anything about Isaiah Selman being musical?
No, I think my type of music had already gone out of style by the time I.W. was in his prime. I think our family has more of a history of being non-musical. Our Christmas dinners, it was really, really hard. You notice Jews having Christmas dinners, but we'll leave that aside. Getting Christmas songs to sound like anything but mush was nearly impossible. So there have been various members. I don't know if you're
actually, I read a piece that Francis wrote about Jews celebrating Christmas in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I mean, it was commonplace.
That's right. You know, everybody associates Christmas now with the birth of Jesus and the celebration of that. But Christmas has much deeper roots, roots stretching back, you know, thousands of years. And when Jews came to California in the 1850s, they celebrated a winter holiday with a tree and with Santa Claus and with the exchange of presents. And they did not regard it as a Christian holiday. And it was very commonplace for Jews to celebrate Christmas. And it wasn't really until the Eastern European Jews started coming to the United States in large numbers in the 1880s that people began to question, why are Jews celebrating Christmas? Because before then, it was just this winter holiday. So you're right. I just wrote a piece because I've celebrated Christmas my entire life. I love Christmas. I don't think of it as a Christian holiday. And I get a lot of flack for it.
In fact, I think it was Isaiah Selman's daughter who had a Santa party or something like that. So we have all those kind of historical records of that. Also, I was interested to read that when he set up a board on the bank, he put on made sure they had 7 Gentiles and 4 Jews. He wanted it not to seem like, you know, the Jews were in control or something along those lines, which was really kind of fascinating because it's like Freud with Ernest Jones or something along those lines. And yet that stereotype about Jews as bankers was something that really played into the 20th century in a major way, even though I saw a study about 20 years ago that said that most of the bankers in the United States are Yankees, of course, you know, patrician, blue blood kind of, well, Gentiles, not kind of, but they are, as opposed to being Jews. But anti-Semitism just generally wasn't as much of a problem here in the West, particularly in the two places Isaiah Selman was, L.A. and San Francisco, like it was back east.
That's right. That's one of the great stories of California that I hope people will find out about by reading Towers of Gold, which is that for Jews, this was a wonderful state to come to and to prosper. When Jews went to New York or New Orleans or other cities, they had to fit into existing social structures, and it was a more complex rise to affluence. But California, remember, was mostly unsettled until the founding of gold in 1848. And Jews, like people all around the world, flooded to California to try to make their living as miners or merchants or whatever. And when they got here, they didn't have existing structures that they had to fit into. So from the very beginning, they were allowed to essentially do whatever they wanted. And Jews were on the city council in Los Angeles in the 1850s. They were very prominent starting from the early days of the state. And this continued almost uninterrupted through the 1890s. And, of course, then in the early part of the 20th century, attitudes changed pretty dramatically in California. And in a period of exclusion began. But until that point, Jews were able to contribute enormously.
And Isaiah Selman founded the first synagogue in Los Angeles, which became the Wilshire Boulevard Reform Temple, well known even to this day. But he was anti-Zionist. He actually, in fact, wrote a petition, as I understand it, to President Woodrow Wilson saying, don't let this territory become a Jewish state.
Right. Well, Isaiah Selman had emigrated from Germany and had found his place in American society and was very content with being an American citizen. And he felt that Jews should be allowed to be citizens in whatever country they grew up in. And wherever they lived, and that they didn't need to go to another new country in order to find full citizenship. So he was opposed to the founding of Palestine after World War I for that reason, and for another reason, which is that 600,000 Arabs lived in that region, and he felt it would be very difficult to put a Jewish state on top of those 600,000 Arabs. And of course, his concerns and that of other people have come true, and it's a very complicated situation there.
He's also a man who was anti-union, we should mention, which is not so surprising since he was a kind of plutocrat entrepreneur. Warren Hellman, what do you feel about the legacy? I mean, you were saying, you know, you were proud when you were in New York. You want to say, what about my great-grandfather? I mean, what do you feel about the legacy that's come down to you?
I mean, from my standpoint, what Francis has done has lifted the cloak off obscurity, which I.W. Hellman should not have had. You know, I think I'm personally extremely proud of the legacy he left behind. I think He and the family did not get a lot of the credit that I think, I don't know if credit is due. Right now, credit is kind of tough to find. But
yeah, in fact, there's a big lesson in this book about credit when you think about it. I mean, your great-grandfather was somebody who knew, it seems, when to extend it and when to hold back on it.
Well, this would have been, this is the kind of era in which he shone. I mean, every time there was a financial crisis, which there were, Panic of 1893, et cetera. His reaction to it was to create stability, to reinsert confidence in the system. And one of the most interesting anecdotes or stories in Francis, it's not a story, it's true. Well, I guess that's a story. I don't know. In Francis's book is how he helped to stop the, in fact, the name of the book.
It's a title. It's in the title,
The help to stop, I think it was the Panic of 1893. And that has a lot of parallels to today.
He just put all these gold coins, stacked them up, and said, you know, here, sort of like what H.L. Hunt did with silver, but in the opposite consequence.
He tried to corner silver and it collapsed. You know, the fact that there were these towers, these piles of gold in the bank, I believe, Francis, correct me, that at the end of the day, they had more deposits than they had at the beginning of the day.
Well, it's a great story, and I'd love to share it with people because I think Warren's right. I mean, if we had someone like this today to instill confidence in our economic system, we'd be better off. In 1893, America was thinking of going off the gold standard, and it prompted a lot of European investors to take their money out of the markets, which triggered a stock market collapse. And, you know, people in California had always been so far away from the financial centers in New York that they thought they were immune to the vicissitudes of the economy. And so they were a little bit glib about this Panic of 1893 going on in New York. And Hellman at that point was president of the Nevada Bank in San Francisco, and his brother Herman was heading up the Farmers and Merchants Bank in L.A. And one day, all these people in Los Angeles got very frightened, and they rushed to the banks in L.A., and they started to withdraw their money. And, you know, so many people took out so much money that the banks started to close. So Herman Hellman telegraphed his brother Isaias to come down and bring more money. And Hellman at first sort of, you know, rejected all this suggestion. He thought, oh, this is not really a bank panic. But he finally realized that there was a crisis, and he loaded up $500,000 of his own money from the Nevada Bank onto a train to L.A. And when it pulled into the L.A. Depot, hordes of people rushed to watch Hellman unload these bags of gold. And he took them to the bank and he piled the gold coin onto the counter. He piled them into towers of gold, which is why I call my book that. And just the sight of all that gold was like a tonic. People saw that there was enough money to go around, and the panic stopped immediately.
There's a lot to learn when we think about the financial crisis today, don't you think, Warren Hellman?
A great deal.
Yeah.
You know, I wish he was in charge today. He would have used the $800 billion effectively.
Well, we don't know how it's being used anyway, so.
That's right. And they would have known how it was being used. Sure. There's a lot of lessons in that story.
And I want to get the genealogy right here. Your first cousin's once removed, so right. Your relationship with his...
Her father. Her father was Lloyd Dinkelspiel, Jr. Lloyd was...
That's another thing Jews didn't do back east. They didn't use juniors. They didn't, you know, Roman numerals after the name was not, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't have any Jimmy Three Sticks or anything like that. But, sorry. But so Lloyd Dinkelspiel and I were first cousins. Our mother, my father, and her mother, his mother, were brother and sister. So that's there were three brothers and a sister.
Now, Frances wrote about being a young girl and getting a VIP card at Wells Fargo Bank. What, you have experiences like that from your youth?
I got a pair of pants.
Oh. Okay.
I went to visit my Uncle Warren, who was president. He said, "You can't wear clothes like that." What was the name of his assistant? I don't know. Tweeny, go out and buy this bull lad some pants.
Yeah, by the third generation, the favors were not extended.
It gets pretty diluted, doesn't it? But you know, you're talking about those towers of gold. Actually, banks were minting their own money back in Isaias' day.
Well, as I said, you know, banks were illegal for a long time in California. California was founded on gold. The people who drew up the Constitution thought we should be able to operate on gold. And for a long time, there was no U.S. mint here, so people would, you know, mine for gold and then make it into bank slugs, and banks were which weren't legal were making up their own coin, as you said.
There's a lot of sense of your great great grandfather really bringing stability to markets, though. I mean, not only in Los Angeles, which he did help really transform from kind of a frontier outpost, but San Francisco. I mean, he has a very extraordinary kind of dual identity in both major cities.
Yeah, he does. And I say that he's the man who tamed the financial system of the Wild West, just because he did create the first successful bank in L.A., which brought credit to the region. I mean, prior to that, if you wanted to open a business or buy a farm, you had to go to a private money lender, and you'd have to borrow money from 5 to 15% interest a month. And this is why a lot of the dons, the former California elite in California, lost their lands, because they borrowed against their land and they didn't understand about compound interest, and their small loans ballooned into enormous, enormous debt. So Hellman was able to lower the interest rates on money offered in L.A. And then also in San Francisco, for example, after the earthquake, he was able to calm the financial markets.
One thing he didn't do in the world of banking was that led to the founding of the Bank of America. Giannini said, "Hey, we can give small loans, right, to immigrants," and he didn't want to go along with that.
No. You're right. I joke that Isaias Hellman was not only responsible for Wells Fargo Bank, but also for the Bank of America. And that's because he was Hellman sat on the board of the Columbus Savings and Loan, and A.P. Giannini got a seat on that board after his father-in-law died. And Giannini had seen all these Italian immigrants come into North Beach and look for money, and he thought that Savings and Loan should lend the money. And so he suggested that to the board and to Isaias Hellman, who sort of dismissed him out of hand. That was not the way banks did business back then. So Giannini quit, went and formed the Bank of Italy, and eventually that became the Bank of America, one of the world's largest banks.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Frances Dinkelspiel and Warren Hellman about their ancestor, Isaias Wolf Hellman. The book is Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California's Fascinating Story. And extraordinary history of the state of California, making Kevin Starr probably drool at the mouth. You can join us. In fact, we invite your calls and welcome them. It's toll-free, wherever you're listening to us or however, on the radio, internet, or Sirius XM satellite. We welcome your thoughts and questions and certainly comments, and join the conversation. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about really an underappreciated figure in California history, Isaias Wolf Hellman, and Frances Dinkelspiel, his great-great-granddaughter, has written a biography of him called Towers of Gold, subtitled How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California. That is a bit histrionic, isn't it?
You know, that L.A. Times reviewer said I proved it. I think I proved it. It wasn't my original subtitle. The publisher really wanted it. But since I do try to show he was involved in eight industries, I think I can maybe make that
claim. You can stand behind it. Good. Frances Dinkelspiel is here with us in studio. She's a former reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and freelance journalist. And her cousin, Warren Hellman, is also with us of Hellman & Friedman, leading venture capital firm, also founder of Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, and great-grandson of California financier Isaias Hellman, and, by the way, also a member of the KQED board.
Recently. Yeah.
Well, glad to have you aboard on the
Maybe
board.
After this interview, they'll want to rethink it.
I doubt it. Let me go to our calls. And our first caller is Yael. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
And
I didn't say I was, but it's nice of you to say. My voice sounds better. Yes.
Wishful thinking. I am wondering whether Francis and Warren are aware of a community mural in Los Angeles that was painted in 1985. I was the director of the project, which was sponsored by the Jewish Federation. It's a 100-foot-long mural on the history of the Los Angeles Jewish community, and it includes the Hellman family. It is on the side of the parking lot for Cantor's Delicatessen. Have you seen the mural?
You know, I haven't seen that mural, and I'm very sorry that I haven't. And the next time I go to L.A., I will look at it.
I've been at Cantor's Delicatessen, however.
I saw a mural in Long Beach that had an image of Hellman on it, because there's a Hellman area there. But I haven't seen that one about the history of Jews in L.A., so I will look for it.
And thank you, Yael, for the call. And on we go to more of your calls. Ken, joining us from San Rafael. Morning, Ken.
Good morning. Hi. Hey, I just have a quick question. I recently finished a book by John Jakeson, a historical novel called California Gold. And in that book, there is a character that strikes an uncanny resemblance to your Hellman, named Hellman. And I was wondering if it was the same Hellman.
Well, you know, I saw that book. I haven't read the whole thing, but I think the Hellman in Jakes' book is a lot meaner than Isaias Hellman ever was, if I remember correctly. I think he might have taken the name, but I don't think it's really based on Hellman's life, because nobody really knew about Hellman's life until recently.
Isn't it ironic, though, that when you all this work you've done, and it's good, dogged research, commend you on that, but that suddenly you have Lehman Brothers, you have the Tribune. I mean, all these things almost happening as if there's strange serendipity at work or something.
Well, I have a parody on my website that my brother wrote about how now venture capitalists are buying my book to see which business is going to fail next, because so many businesses associated with Hellman that I loud and talk about in the book have gone under. Lehman Brothers, right, the Los Angeles Times, you know, the whole banking industry. So we have a family joke about that.
What do you
that.
Think? There's some oracle operating here, Warren Hellman, maybe? I mean, what do you as a venture capitalist think when you...
What terrifies me, Michael, we have a statement called shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, but maybe that hasn't happened. But the Chinese have a saying, coolie to coolie in four generations. So, you know, maybe that's what we're getting to. I think particularly the demise of Lehman Brothers is a true tragedy and maybe the greatest mistake of this administration. Why did they save all the other financial institutions and not Lehman Brothers? And they're probably good reasons, but I don't know them.
They remain mysterious. We'll go to another caller, and that's Wafa from San Leandro. Morning.
Good morning. I appreciate the program that you're talking about, but you started out with something that's very dear to me, and that is how immigrants, when they come here, they celebrate the holidays that everyone else celebrates. And I am from a Muslim background, and I remember this holiday being so special, similar to what was talked about earlier. It's my father's favorite holiday, and we celebrated Christmas. We put trees. We did all the things that Christians do, but so did the Jews that lived next door to us, so did the Hindus that were near us. So a lot of people do celebrate this holiday because it's a national holiday, and we need that like we have in our own countries. When it's a holiday, the whole atmosphere is celebrating holidays.
Well, Wafa, I must tell you, not to necessarily plug a program that we've done for Christmas Day, but I will. On Christmas Day, we did an interview with someone who wrote a candid history of Christmas. And what you discover is, of course, there's a religious Christmas celebration, but there's also a cultural and national celebration, which takes in all denominations. And I'm so thankful that you brought in your own experience. Appreciate that call. We'll go to more of your calls, and we go to KC next. KC, morning.
Hi, good morning. There is an interesting folklore about A.P. Giannini that may be true of Mr. Hellman banking-wise, and that is that during the Great Depression, when people couldn't make their mortgage payments, Giannini basically said sort of like George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, well, what can you afford to pay me? So their overall mortgage debt didn't change, but they gave them a super wide leeway in terms of what they could pay monthly to keep them in their homes. And isn't that a lesson we could apply today?
You're absolutely right. Hellman, there are a number of instances that I found refused to foreclose on mortgages that had not been paid for a long period of time, and he did that for two reasons: one, out of a sense of humanity, he didn't want to force people out of their homes, and two, he also felt that he would be criticized as a Jew for doing that, and he wrote very explicitly that since he was Jewish, he needed to be extra cautious and go out of his way even more than people who, the bankers who weren't Jewish. So he definitely held that in his mind.
And we thank you for the call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. Certainly, he gave a lot back. I mean, philanthropically, it's quite a record. There's also a lot of, for those who are more interested maybe in scandals, there's, you know, some of that in this story too.
Yeah, that was the fun part to find out about. Yeah, there's an assassination attempt, which I mentioned. There's a huge embezzlement, the largest embezzlement in California banking history at that time.
From one of the relatives.
From one of the relatives, which really broke Isaias Hellman's heart. You know, he lived very grandly. His son's house is called Dunsmere Hellman Historic Estate in Oakland, and that's now open to the public. His house in Tahoe, which was the first mansion built in Lake Tahoe, is a state park, too, called Sugar Pine Point State Park. So Towers of Gold is filled with, you know, lots of family drama, great wealth.
Son great, born out of wedlock?
Yes. Not his son, his brother's son.
Yes, Hermit's son.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's lots of juice there, as we say. Yeah?
Absolutely.
And, in fact, Doris, one of our listeners, has a story about one of the houses that you just mentioned. Doris, hi.
Hi. When I was in high school, or junior high school in San Leandro, my classmates and I rented horses, and we went riding up in the hills behind San Leandro, and we came on this huge white house that we didn't even know was there, and there wasn't a soul around, and it was scary because it was so big and imposing and nobody there. And we rode around a little bit, but we didn't get it close to the house because we were afraid there was something wrong. It just seemed like it was spooky. Yeah. And we found out later that it belonged to somebody named Hellman. And now it's called Dunsmuir House, and it belongs to the city of Oakland, I think. And it's just a beautiful, big house.
Yeah, but it scared you, huh?
It scared us because it was so quiet. There wasn't a soul around. It was just, I guess there was probably someone there, but we didn't see anyone. And, of course, we didn't know exactly what it was.
It
was almost as if it was a fairy castle, you know, something ephemeral that would float away.
Well, it's good of you to call with that memory, Doris. And Francis Dinklispiel, you had a response.
Well, you know, the affluent in San Francisco often in the 19th and early 20th century, they didn't own their own homes in San Francisco. They rented, and they owned these large country estates. So the Hellmans bought this beautiful piece of property in 1906, and the family occupied it for 50 years. But lots of these pieces of property were not winterized, so families would only spend, you know, from May until October then. So perhaps Doris rode during the winter months when no one was living there. I, unfortunately, did not get to spend time there. Warren spent a lot of time there, and it was just, you know, the base of fantastic, you know, music and incredible visitors, and really was a sort of center of culture and politics to some degree in the Bay Area.
In fact, I remember as a young man going to the Zellerbach estate, and I joked and I said it made me want to be a socialist again. But there is a sense when you read this story that you, particularly in San Francisco, just getting a local history here about all these German Jews and how prominent they were and what fabulous lives they had, I mean, in terms of what they were able to build out of their lives and so forth, as opposed to, again, the R crowd of Stephen Birmingham in New York, you know, which was much less cultural, much less political, and very dramatically different. You were going to say what?
The memory that Francis, what you both said, brings back. During the summer, we spent a lot of the summer at San Leandro, and Francis's father was working at the Dodge plant in Oakland, and I was working as a lifeguard, and I could always remember coming back with him and his duds from working in the factory, and me with my lifeguard stuff on, and sitting on the front porch being served daiquiris by Granny's butler.
It's a warm memory, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a nostalgic memory.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have, when you wrote that song, you have a picture of your great-grandfather crossing the isthmus and all that? Did that kind of get into your skull?
You know, that's a great point. We're coming out with a CD, and we're looking for graphics. And that would be a hell of a graphic. That's a good idea.
Seems a very good one to me, yeah. But I wondered when you write a song like that, how much you conceptualize, how much goes through your visual imagination?
Well, you sort of, I don't know, I'm not much of a songwriter. You ought to get a real songwriter here. But when the idea came to me, the first thing I did is call Francis and said, you know, would you like me to write a song about Isaias? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, tell me what to write. What should I put in it? And every verse was an idea from Francis's book, from Towers of Gold. So,
well, we had a composer on yesterday. We had John Adams on yesterday.
Oh, nice.
Now we have Judy joining us from Redwood City. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. Good morning, Francis and Warren. I'm Jim's mother, Francis, and I just think it's marvelous that you have written this book about your great-great-grandfather and Warren's great-grandfather, because my family also was from the same town, and now it's straight. I cannot keep all the people in alignment and who they were, but I now have all the facts.
Well, help us. Who's Jim?
My son is Jim Harris.
She's talking about the Walter family. She's a descendant of the Walter family, and they also came from Reckendorf, and they were very prominent in San Francisco. They owned a wholesale rug and carpet and furniture business. But all the Walters have intermarried, and they actually are the most intermarried to the R crowd in New York, the Seligmans and the Contents and all this stuff. So the Walter name has really disappeared largely from San Francisco, with the exception of a company called D&E Walter, which is a descendant of the carpet company, which still exists. And one funny thing that I have loved about Towers of Gold is it shows that the Hellmans, Walters, and Haas's families have known each other probably since the 1700s, and they've continued to do business with one another until today. Until like 2 weeks ago, Warren Hellman sat on the board of Levi Strauss, and he sits on the board of D&E Walter. So I carry this image in my mind of these families who have collaborated and supported one another for generation after generation, and we're still continuing to do it today.
And we thank Judy for the call. Do you know the word yucca? Warren, do you know it? It's a word. I'm not sure the origins of it. Maybe one of our listeners knows. It's a word that's used synonymously with German Jews, and it was used. It's a little bit onomatopoeic. I don't know necessarily if it's meant to be, but it just was something that I found myself etymologically curious about and thought maybe both of you might know. There was, in fact, a real resistance to by many of these German Jews who had established themselves to the Eastern European Jews when they came in. Couldn't get in the same clubs and all those kinds of things.
We finally had a club that we could get into. Why should we let them in?
That's right. Well, but, you know, what's striking also about the story of Isaias Hellman is his recognition and his consciousness about being Jewish, of course, you know, which played a preeminent role.
Absolutely. And I'd like to go back to this point about the German Jews versus the Eastern European Jews, because while that conflict existed, I also think it helped bring a different kind of consciousness to the German Jews that played out in World War I and World War II. I mean, the German Jews were at the top of the heap when the flood of immigrants came from Russia and Eastern Europe. And initially, they were very resistant to these people because they spoke Yiddish. They weren't as well educated. They looked different. But eventually they began to sort of build, you know, settlement houses and extend charity to these people. But then in the 1880s and onward, when the Tsar started to kill the Jews en masse, the German Jews realized that there was no institution in the United States to stand up and support and try to protect these people. So they formed the American Jewish Committee, which was the first national organization to speak out against discrimination against Jews. And that had its own history, but it went on to be a very effective organization that tried to sort of thwart some of the killings that was going on. So even though the German Jews initially resisted the entrance of the Eastern European Jews, I think that relationship transformed them in a positive way.
Well, actually, I've got somebody here who knows about the Yekka. Or Judith, hi.
Yeah, hi, Michael.
You know where Yekka comes from?
The understanding of the term is that it comes from the word for a little jacket or short jacket that the German Jews wore in contrast to the long kaftans that the Eastern European Jews wore. So there's a noun, Yekka, which means a German Jew, and Yekkish is the adjective.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I just brought the word up because I didn't know its origins, and thank you for that. As good as Leo Rostin. In fact, anti-Semitism, of course, is often used as a blaming. There's the old joke about the guy who didn't get a job as a radio announcer, and they asked him why, and he said anti-Semitism. But do you think the reason that Warren Hellman was not given his due historically had anything to do with the fact that he was Jewish?
Isaias Hellman.
Well, Warren Hellman. We could include in that, too. But we're back to that generation and the historicity of this in terms of anti-Semitism. Was it a factor?
I think his Jewishness had something to do with why he hasn't been afforded as much recognition as he perhaps deserves. But I don't think it was anti-Semitism, exactly. Hellman came from this long line of men who had been denied, you know, doing whatever they wanted in Germany for a long, long time. And I think he grew up in that environment and came to the United States where he was very successful. And at the same time, he was loath to sort of brag about his accomplishments. He gave money generously. He built these nice houses. But he didn't put his name on buildings or anything like that because I think he was afraid as a Jew, if he extended himself too far, if he put his name out there too far, there would be a backlash. So I think the fact that he didn't tout his accomplishments as much as he might have led eventually to him sort of disappearing from the landscape.
He needed a good publicist.
Right? He sure did.
Well, he got one a couple of generations later. But he also, he was a partner to just about every member of the Yankee gentry of California. Really.
That's right. His partner, you know, he bought the Nevada Bank from John Mackey, who was one of the Silver Kings, an Irishman who'd made a fortune in the Comstock Lode. Ed Harriman, who was a huge railroad magnate, he bought the Southern Pacific Railroad eventually, and Hellman bought Wells Fargo Bank from Harriman, and they went on to build trolley lines in Southern California together. And he had very close relationships also with Collis Huntington. He was a good friend to Jew and non-Jew.
And Chandler of the L.A. Times,
right?
Of course, and so forth. And he was a regent for many years.
He served as a regent for 37 years for the University of California. And he also donated the land that helped start the founding of the University of Southern California.
Warren, you're going to say something?
Well, one of the stories I've liked the best, the floods. The Silver Kings were Mackey Fair, Flood, and O'Brien. And Flood's great-granddaughter and I were sitting at a dinner table with a very upscale English woman. She said, "Oh, you Americans are so darling. Tell me about your ancestors." And Judy said, "Well, Warren here's great-grandfather worked in a dry goods store. My great-grandfather was a bartender. What about you?" And she said, "Oh, we have always been landed."
We're talking about Isaias Wolf Hellman. A couple of times, by accident, maybe Warren's channeling his great-grandfather. I've said mixed up the name Warren and Isaias, which I apologize for. But here's something about the name Dinkelspiel. Robbie says, "I work at Stanford, and we have an auditorium named Dinkelspiel. Since most buildings are named after a benefactor alumni, is there a relationship?"
Yes, there is a relationship, and I actually went to Stanford, and when I walked around with my name tag, Francis Dinkelspiel, everyone said, "I know why you got into Stanford," but that wasn't true because not all my relatives got in, so I thought of changing my name to Francis Auditorium. I thought that would be interesting. Anyway, my grandmother, Florence Hellman, married Lloyd Dinkelspiel, my grandfather, and Lloyd Dinkelspiel served as president of the Board of Trustees at Stanford University for a long time. And when my grandmother died prematurely, she was just 48 years old, he donated money along with other family members to build Dinkelspiel Auditorium.
listener named Matt who says, in listening to your program today, I find it hard to believe Miss Dinkelspiel's portrayal of her grandfather, great-great-grandfather, by the way, Matt, as a purely laudable figure in California history. I'm no expert in the history of our state, but I've read enough to know about some of the machinations involved in the issue of water rights around the state, to say nothing of banking and other interests of her great-great-grandfather. On balance, he may have had a positive impact on the development of our state, but the book as described comes off as more of a puff piece, similar to biographies of Hearst and others, rather than a serious historical work. Forgive me if this comes off as too harsh.
Well, of course it comes off as harsh, and I invite you to read Towers of Gold. I'm a journalist by profession. I've worked for some of the, you know, biggest papers and magazines in the United States, and I love dirt. Are you kidding? I think what makes this book interesting is Isaiah Hellman's foibles and problems.
What about his dark side?
His dark side. Well, he had a dark side on some level. I mean, on a personal level, I think as he grew older and more affluent, he also grew more arrogant, which made him less patient.
That's an equation that usually follows, isn't it?
which made him less patient with people he didn't feel were as quick or swift or rich or successful as himself. And I do think on some level he felt that his success was due to his own hard work and not necessarily luck in the time he came from. You know, this isn't a puff piece because I do talk about, there's one allegation of payoff that I discuss in the book. He had a very tortured relationship with his brother that I talk about in the book. But, you know, it's hard to describe in 30-second sound bites more complicated issues in a man's life. So read Towers of Gold and then call me up or send me an email and tell me if you think I've just done a nice puff piece.
There's dirt in them, they're gold. Or instead, right? And by the way, if you'd like to join us at the time remaining, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And we go to Oakland. David, morning.
Yeah, wonderful program. We're a little late, but Cherchez la Femme, please talk for the rest of the program about the women in these men's lives. I mean, there has to be a completely equally interesting story behind all that.
Well, I agree. Hellman was married to a woman named Esther Neugass, who was the sister of the woman married to Meyer Lehman, the founder of Lehman Brothers. And Esther grew up in a more affluent home in Germany, and she came to New York, where she met Isaiah Hellman through an arranged marriage. And they took the train across the country, and she sort of went from living in the beautiful homes of Würzburg to this dusty pueblo where violence was very common. And her life is really also the story of the transformation of the American woman in the 19th century. At first, she was just engaged with her home life, but slowly and surely, she sort of extended herself into the public sphere. She was a big advocate of kindergartens. She started one of the first kindergartens for Jewish children in San Francisco. She was very philanthropic, and she helped out with Mount Zion Hospital. So she began as a woman who was, you know, very sheltered, but by the end of her life, she had gone on and helped a lot of people around her. And that is the story of the transformation of women as they entered the 20th century.
It's amazing to what extent these families intermarried. I mean, it was like really almost kind of an aristocracy. Did that go down as far as the ongoing generations, or to what extent did it?
One of the questions I'm frequently asked, that this is really for Francis to answer, is, are you a cousin of everybody in San Francisco? And I said, and my answer is everybody with some Jewish background, yeah. Because who did you marry?
That's right. I mean, there was a lot of intermarriage, like between the Fleischackers and Slosses and Gersels and Hellmans and Dinkelspiels and Greenbaums. And yeah, there was this small group of people who actually formed this sort of elitist society. They were members of Temple Emmanuel, members of the Concordia Club. They all socialized together, and naturally they turned to one another as potential spouses. But that doesn't really exist today. I mean, although...
Well, actually, you know, the Wall Street Journal had an article about... Sorry to bring up the name again, but Bernard Madoff. And to some extent, they were saying that same kind of insularity and people trusting him because he was Jewish, Jewish organizations went bankrupt completely because they gave him money and he was turning out good returns. And so they felt a great deal of confidence in him. And the result is, you know, there are a lot of people now who have and organizations now who are bereft.
He wouldn't have fooled the founding Lehmans, I'll tell you. There was a fantastic story. Ivor Kruger, the match king, was one of the great con men in history, and he came in to see the two brothers Lehman to try to promote the international match company. And at the end of an hour, one brother said to the other, Meyer, did you understand Mr. Krueger? He said, no, I'm afraid I didn't. And he said, I'm very sorry, Mr. Krueger, but my brother and I don't do business with people that we can't understand in an hour. And, you know, there are institutions with a lot of Jews and with no Jews that when they asked Mr. Madoff or his lieutenants for real substantive information, got a sheet of paper with nothing on it.
One quick call here from Liam that I want to get on here because he wants to thank you, Warren, for the Bluegrass Festivals. Hi, Liam.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for joining us. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I really look forward to reading this book as I'm interested in California history. And I wanted to thank Mr. Hellman for the Bluegrass Festival. I've been about every year so far, and it's the highlight of my year for sure.
That's the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, and Warren Hellman deserves his bona fides. Thank you for that. In fact, we're going to go out with the song that we've been talking about, that Warren Hellman and his crew, Oh Isaias, the Wranglers performing. And I want to thank our guests. The book again, Towers of Gold, Francis Dinkelspiel, thank you for being with us. Warren Hellman, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
And thank you, our listeners. Thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Dave Freeman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And here it is again, O Isaias.
I.W. Hellman, he was
good stuff, you guys. Thank you.
Came to California in his 16th year. Rode across the Isthmus to come here and become California's greatest financier. Isaias went to work in a dry goods store. Said, this is not what I came
here. Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.